You're listening to a podcast edition of Closer to Truth. For more information about this series, visit our website, closertotruth.com.
Welcome to Closer to Truth Chats. I'm speaking with Nicholas Humphrey about his challenging, ambitious, original new book, Sentience, The Invention of Consciousness. Nick, it's great to see you. It's been over a decade since we last discussed consciousness. What's been happening in the field and how does sentience contribute?
Well, in a way, I think the field has been rather retrograde. A lot of the ideas which we were very confident about 10, 15 years ago are being challenged from the left field by the panpsychist movement, which has become so popular with under a lot of different headings, with integrated information theory, with quantum field effects and so on, David Chalmers's dualism. I'm in fact, I think, fighting a rear guard against it because I regard a lot of this new stuff as nonsense and retrograde.
Well, I'm not going to tell you which side of the fence I'm sitting on, but I generally like to sit on both sides of the fence. Depends who I'm talking to. I take the opposite side from whoever I speak with. You contrast your changing perspectives on the problems of consciousness with the unchanging perspective of your good friend and our good friend at Closer to Truth, Dan Dennett. In the course of your own research, first in neuroscience, then in animal behavior, you said you've seen things that have changed your perspective even more than once. You say cutely that Dan has been rather proud of having stuck to his guns, and you are proud of being a turncoat. So what coats have you turned?
Well, I should say from the start that Dan and I have always been materialists. So in that sense, we're wearing the same coat, and I'm sure always will do. What I meant by that was not so much I've turned my coat, but I've turned it inside out several times to wear it the other way around. I started off by thinking that social intelligence was the main clue to understanding consciousness. I pulled away from that because I couldn't see how that could deal with qualia. I spent a long time arguing for a new theory of qualia, but eventually when I was trying to think of why qualia would have evolved, I returned to the idea of the phenomenal self as the chief driver of social psychology in animals like ourselves.
Yeah, I thought that was one of the great contributions of the book, precisely that, the phenomenal consciousness, how it deals with social issues and the nature of the self. We're going to get to all of that. We're going to focus on the core of your theories of consciousness, what consciousness is, how it evolved, which creatures have it. But first, let me introduce you properly. Nicholas Humphrey is a theoretical psychologist known for his work in the evolution of intelligence and consciousness. Emeritus professor of psychology at the London School of Economics, he was the first to demonstrate the existence of blind sight in monkeys. He then studied mountain gorillas with Diane Fossey in Rwanda, proposed the theory of the social function of intellect, and investigated the evolutionary background, this was fascinating, of religion, art, healing, death awareness, and even suicide. His most recent books prior to Sentience are Seeing Red and Soul Dust. Nick, what struck me about your book when I first got it was that loaded word in the title, invention, the invention of consciousness, not the essence, the mystery, the meaning, or whatever of consciousness, but the invention of consciousness. Now, in mathematics, we like to distinguish the philosophical difference between math being invented and math being discovered. So is there a similar distinction with respect to consciousness, not the discovery of consciousness by humans and philosophy or science, but the invention of consciousness by evolution?
Well, I mean the invention in two different ways. One is, I think that consciousness is an invention in the sense that a musical invention is an invention. It's a play, a kind of playful take on what can be done with instruments and what can be thrown out by as an art form. And I think consciousness is, in that sense, an extraordinary invention, an extraordinary work of art. But I also mean it in the sense that consciousness has been invented by natural selection, starting from nothing. There was no phenomenal consciousness in the world until, well, we'll have to say until when, but certainly there wasn't any at the beginning of life on Earth. So it came into being because of the creative power of natural selection. And also in the book, I invent things in a different way. I try to go back in history and not I don't try and deconstruct consciousness as we experience it today. I go back to the beginning and try to invent it from scratch. And so I'm playing with the term invention in a lot of different senses.
Good. I like that a lot. Now, we're going to be discussing a lot of topics, broad general topics in terms of evolution or the hard problem of consciousness, very specific applications like AI and social intelligence. But what I want to do is to get your overview, get a clear organizing principle of your core thesis, your core conjectures, I won't say conclusions, but your conjectures, and the rough flow of your argument, just very briefly.
Well, the book, as you know, has three different sections, really. The first part of it tells a lot of stories about my own involvement with research on consciousness. And I do that partly just to prepare the ground to introduce concepts so that people will have a kind of real experience of what it was like to be there working on these issues, working on blindsight, working on social intelligence, because I think that informs the philosophy which I develop later. I think, I don't want to brag about this, but I think that a lot of philosophers who write on these subjects have never got their hands dirty. They've never done research. They've never worked with gorillas in the field. They haven't. We've been in the lab recording from single cells. And I think it's actually important in terms of my own development that I was there. I was actually present in the field and in the lab. So that the book begins with that. But then I turn to what I consider to be the main issue to be, and I go back to basics. I try and distinguish from the beginning the phenomenal consciousness from cognitive consciousness. The problem which we all find most difficult is trying to understand the nature of qualia, of phenomenal experience, the redness of red or the sweetness of honey, how it comes through to us in a kind of magical way, as if it doesn't really belong in the material world. Now, that's, of course, what has prompted many people to say there is a hard and probably insoluble problem about consciousness, that it really doesn't belong in the material world, and no physicalist explanation is ever going to get there. I take that on board and I say, well, let's see first what we're talking about. We're talking about something very special, and it is the phenomenal feel of sensory experience. That's the basic problem. And I think for many people, it is what they mean as the major issue of consciousness. That's what they care about. They don't care about the cognitive aspects of it, though they're interested in it, decision-making, judgments, perception, and so on. They want to know about the nature of raw feels. And I agree, that's where we should start. So I take that as the beginning point and then ask what kind of thing is at issue here. Now, the crucial insight, I think, is that consciousness is a representation. It's an idea. It's an idea we have about what's happening to us. And we represent it as having certain miraculous, strange properties. But if we're trying to understand how the brain can generate that, how the brain can represent it, it's very important to realize that the brain doesn't have to have the properties it represents. When we represent the color red as having the qualities of red sensations, of red qualia, it doesn't mean that anything in the brain actually has those properties. It means that the brain is telling a story about something which could in principle have those stories. And I think the notion of a story is actually crucial here. I mean, the brain is providing in a sense a text, which it then reads in order to arrive at a certain picture of the world. But just as the text of Moby Dick doesn't have to be white or whale-like in any way, it just has to represent those qualities. So what's going on in the brain has to present the brain with this representandum, which can then translate into the terms which we marvel at as being the experience of phenomenal consciousness.
Okay, we will go through this in detail, but I want to start digging in now. And the first place, I'm going to again start with the title, because you have two words in the title. You have sentience and consciousness. And I think it's important to distinguish how you are using those terms, because they're not synonymous. And people can have different feelings of which one is the superset, which one is the subset, can you be one without the other or the other without the one? So give me a precise definition of those two, because that's critical to the whole argument.
Yes, and I think a lot of people don't make the distinction, which I think is crucial, between consciousness, which is simply is self-awareness. It's the ability to reflect on what's going on in one's mind and report to oneself, and also through words and other means to other people around us, to make it clear we know what's happening inside our minds, the structure of our thought, the structure of our decision-making. That's the overall concept. And I actually think it's a clever trick which was invented a very long time back in evolutionary history. I think animals were conscious in that sense. They had this kind of internal picture of their own thought processes before they became sentient. That's in contrast to what most people would say, which is that they think of raw feels and phenomenal consciousness as being primitive. I don't think so at all. It's not raw, it's thoroughly cooked. And in fact, it represents one of the high points, or the high point, of evolution. And it came relatively late. So what I try and do is to drive a wedge between these two concepts and say, yes, there's consciousness, and lots of animals in the world are probably conscious, and lots of machines soon will be conscious in the sense of having this insight into their own minds. And it'll be crucial for their ability to make decisions and make rational choices and so on. It's a clever trick. It was invented by nature a long time ago, probably involving some kind of global workspace, and it'll be repeated in machines as we adopt the same tricks and go on there.
Your distinction between sentience and consciousness is really important to understand your whole thesis, because frankly, if a priori going in, my sense of being sentient was having the capacity to sense things, whereas consciousness in my own sense was phenomenal consciousness. So I would have sentience being the larger category of any amoeba that reacts to the environment, and consciousness being the phenomenal consciousness. But your definition is entirely appropriate, but we need to recognize the consistency of your argument, so when you use those terms, we understand what you mean, because your consciousness is broader and has what you call cognitive consciousness, which is not sentience or not phenomenal consciousness. Is that right?
Yes, I think you're using sentience in a very simple way, which in fact doesn't correspond to the way people use it when they are talking about it, for example, in relation to the moral issues of cruelty to animals and so on. I mean, lots of an amoeba is sentient in the sense it has sense organs and responds to them, but nobody cares about whether there's something it's like that's to be an amoeba, which we shouldn't interfere with and which we should respect because of its moral status. So I'm using sentient in this rather more highfalutin way of being something that is like to be the animal who's sentient. And that, for me, and I talk a lot about it in the book, comes down to there being some aspect of sensory experience which has this other dimension to it, which seems to take us out of this world and provide a kind of magical backdrop to our lives. Now, that is sentience at the other extreme, but I think it's the one people mostly care about. When you read modern discussions about, you know, are lobsters sentient? Could an AI be sentient and so on? If it is, what are we going to do about it? Because doesn't it mean that we are going to have to be careful about the way we treat them in all sorts of ways we wouldn't have bothered about in the past? Then it's the question of whether it feels like something to be sentient for them as it does for us. My reason for making the distinction where I did is partly, of course, to do with my earlier work on blindsight. What the discovery of blindsight did was to drive a wedge between perception and sensation. What blindsight seems to demonstrate is that it's possible to see, to be cognitively aware of objects in the environment, to recognize them, tell their shape and color and so on, at the same time as having no accompanying sensations. For a person with blindsight or a monkey with blindsight, there's nothing it's like to see. And that's the distinction which I want to make, that you can have perception without sensation, and you can have consciousness without without sentience. And I make a point in my book of saying that I think many animals are conscious in the formal sense that they have these cognitive abilities without being sentient. Many animals can see in the sense that they have blind sight, but very few animals probably see in the sense that we do with the accompanying sensation. A long time ago, I wrote an essay about blind sight, which I called it Seeing and Nothingness. It's lacking this crucial dimension. But of course, I might have made the other point, which is that normal seeing is seeing and somethingness. Normal seeing for us is, for our sentient creatures. And the question is, what is this extra somethingness? And what other animals, what machines could possibly be experiencing it?
Yeah, certainly blindsight has been an empirical result, which is surprising to many people. And you focus on it, you originated it in the study of monkeys with Helen, if I think I remember her mm-hmm. name. And then human examples too. I mean, you can have destruction or trauma of the visual cortex, so you don't have the ability to have the phenomenal consciousness of what you're seeing, but people are able to discern their environment in a cognitive way without having the phenomenal sensation. So blindsight, that empirical data, is a critical element in the development of your theory.
Yes, and it makes it clear that sentience, in the way you were suggesting we should use it, doesn't apply. If blindsight is a case of insentient perception, then that means, you know, the sense organs are working perfectly well, but the phenomenology isn't present.
Yeah. So it seems that you have two big questions to deal with the big C, the big consciousness. Big question one is, how did this sentience or phenomenal consciousness? I think those two are fairly synonymous, sentience as you use it and phenomenal consciousness. How did it evolve? How did it happen? And if then we can answer that question to show that it did, we can go on to big question two, and that how could a physically constituted brain generate sentience or phenomenal consciousness? So your distinction between phenomenal consciousness and cognitive consciousness, which is broader, is a primary node in the flow of your overarching argument, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's now kind of go explore that a little bit deeper, because it's so important. You make an interesting comment. You say, I don't believe there's any necessary connection between intelligence and sentience. So intelligence, which relates to the cognitive consciousness, is direct, but sentience and intelligence is not.
I don't think intelligence as such has any part to play in phenomenology of consciousness. You don't have to be clever in order to feel pain. And of course, people have realized that for a long time. When Jeremy Bentham was talking about the moral question of animal pain, said the question isn't whether animals can reason or talk, it's whether they can suffer. I go along with that distinction. You don't have to be able to reason or talk in order or be intelligent in any of the conventional ways in order to have this strange magical experience which we value so much.
Mm. What is consciousness an illusion? This is a part of the analysis of consciousness in the world. There are some people who use that term. Many people ridicule them for saying it, because the illusion of consciousness seems like it is consciousness. Certainly our buddy Dan has used illusion in a very sophisticated way. I think people do not understand what Dan is actually saying when they express amazement at the word of illusion. But from your perspective, you use illusion in interesting ways, where you show impossible triangles, which are clearly illusions, and you wonder if this analogy has anything to do with the quality of seeing red. So describe briefly how the word illusion in consciousness works and how you use it.
Well, Robert, this is actually one of those areas in which I've been a turncoat. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, nearly, when you interviewed me, we talked about the illusion of consciousness. And I went along full-heartedly with Dan Dennett's notion that consciousness represents things which cannot really be true. So it's an illusion, since it's non-veridical. We're inventing it. I don't take that line anymore. I've thought a lot about it, but I've parted ways with illusionism, because I consider phenomenal consciousness to represent for real how we feel about what's happening to us when we see red or feel pain or whatever it may be. We're not in error in asserting that it has these qualities. In the case of an impossible triangle, we are in error. The triangle we see doesn't really have the properties which we think it does. But in the case of sensations, I think that our feelings really have those properties, and it's a mistake to regard that as an illusion, and it's also demeaning it. It's very politically a wrong move, because people think you are saying, well, consciousness somehow doesn't count in that way. But I think it counts for everything there is in the world. It's the most important aspect of our experience, and of course we should recognize it and glorify it as being a real event in our lives, which gives us the truth about what it's like to be ourselves living in this world. So I'm not going to call it an illusion. I've toyed with various other words for it in a paper responding to Keith Frankish about illusionism. I said, well, no, I would rather call consciousness surrealism. It's even more real than the real thing.
I have to tell you that I've spoken to dozens, if not 100 or more people about consciousness over the years. I've read a lot of things, and I am so excited to meet one first-rate scientist or philosopher who has changed his mind on anything. That to me is just a triumph of understanding. So I compliment for you that. It doesn't mean it's right or wrong. It's just the willingness to do that, I think it's terrific.
Well, I'm sure the remark by J.M. Keynes, the economist, when he was asked why he changed his mind so often, he said, well, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? I won't say in that case the facts have changed, but certainly I've come to see the facts in a different way.
Yeah, that's terrific. Okay, we're going to now deal with some of the big core areas of the core argument, and we'll start with evolution, because you say that as a result of all of your studies with the phosphenes in the eye, blind sight, aesthetic preference, social intelligence, theory of mind, even religious awe, each of those encounters have given you a different perspective, and you. Move from that to saying that you now believe that a rather simple evolutionary theory can tie it all together. And then going further, that the destination, which is, I think I'm quoting you correctly, of the evolutionary story is phenomenal consciousness and the enhancement of the self. That sounds a little bit like teleology.
Well, it would be if I said the destination, but I don't think I use that word anywhere in the book. Go back to the beginning of this your line of thought. Yes, I'm an evolutionist. I take it for granted that almost all the interesting aspects of biological life have come into being because they were selected by natural selection, because they served a purpose in the life of the animal. Now, that's at once puts me at odds with a lot of philosophers who write about consciousness, because I assume that consciousness has a function. It changes the life of the animal which has it, and it changes it to give it a greater chance of surviving and reproducing, so that the genes which generate consciousness in development will be passed on to the next generation. So this puts me at odds with philosophers like David Chalmers, for example, who've argued from a long time back that consciousness is actually entirely private. That we can't really ever know whether somebody is having that kind of inner private experience, that there could be unconscious zombies living among us who would, without having any inner experience, without there being anything like to be them, nonetheless would behave in every way in the same way as conscious human beings do. Now, evolutionary theory tells us that just can't be right. If it was so, consciousness could not have evolved. And we've no other explanation of how it's come into the world unless it's evolved. So I take it for granted that consciousness has to have a role in the life of the creature who possesses it. And so all through my evolutionary story, when I try to invent consciousness from nothing, I'm looking for the next step, which would have had some payoff for the animal who possessed it. And I build that up slowly from just the beginning, the value of simply being aware of what's happening at the end and how one responds to stimuli, to all the way up to how this begins to go further than just representing the stimuli as such, but representing how we feel about those stimuli, and how that goes on to have yet another dimension, which gives it this new and interesting qualities, which I think are the basis for selfhood.
To be clear, you have cognitive consciousness going way back, maybe very long, in terms of our evolutionary history, but then phenomenal consciousness, which you call sentience, arriving relatively late. And if that's so, you're saying many of our ancestors then would have been cognitively conscious, but not phenomenally conscious as we know consciousness.
Yes, I mean, we talked earlier about whether you need to be intelligent to have phenomenal consciousness. I don't think you do, but you certainly need to have a particular kind of brain. I don't think that phenomenal consciousness could be generated by a very simple brain, the brain of an amoeba or even of a dragonfly. It requires a brain which is capable of generating a certain rather special kind of internal looping activity, which can go on to become elaborated in extraordinary ways, which we recognize as being phenomenology. Now, that's one reason for saying it came relatively late. But the main reason is that, as I just said a moment ago, I think consciousness must have a function, both cognitive consciousness and phenomenal consciousness. Now, why I can see a function for cognitive consciousness going very far back. Dragonflies and bees and lobsters, I'm sure, all need to appreciate what's going on in the world and to make decisions and so on. And they very likely have some form of cognitive consciousness. They need it because it makes a difference to their lives. What would not make a difference to the life of a lobster or a dragonfly, or a frog, I think, for that matter, would be having this additional dimension of experience. And so that's what I concentrate on in the book in the second half, both to say what it turned into and why it mattered. And then I look at the evidence that only certain animals actually seem to have this sense of self, which is generated by phenomenology of consciousness.
Okay, this is important, and that'll be the third part when we talk about what animals have or have not or do not have a phenomenal consciousness. But sticking in evolution, you obviously deal with the main issue, and you deal with it, the argument from continuity, which is a basic principle of evolution. Most scientists would say that evolution has been a gradual process without very sharp discontinuities. Gould's punctuated equilibrium aside for a second, but in general, in terms of the process, it's been continuous. You can't point to any point in history, as you say, where you can draw a line on many different biological functions in a body of animals. And certainly the argument goes that you can't say unconsciousness or not phenomenal consciousness is on one side, and after this sharp step, it's now phenomenal. It's not phenomenal, but cognitive, and then suddenly it becomes phenomenal.
Robert, can I interrupt you there? I don't say that. I say that there is a threshold.
I'm saying that what I said was what most people say, yeah. And you contradict that. And that's why it's interesting. So we're together. What I said was not what you said. Okay. Everybody else says that. Now we want to hear what you say.
Yes, because I agree. Evolution is progressive, and most of the time it's continuous. You can see only small steps are being taken. But actually, I think that the advent of phenomenal consciousness did involve a kind of saltation, a sudden change in the way the brain worked. And the reason for saying that is, of course, well, I begin with just the facts we know about our experience. There is an absolute difference between being consciously awake, feeling sensations and so on, and being asleep. Friday morning, one's not dreaming. It's not a gradual process. It comes all over us all at once. We wake up to be surrounded by this world of sensations. And that's what I try, and I use that as a basis for saying that something happened of an all or nothing kind in the brain, just as it has an all or difference between nothing difference between sleep and wakefulness. And what I focus in on is feedback loops. Now, feedback loops may sound, you know, pretty simple stuff, and of course people have long been interested in the possibility of feedback being involved in consciousness. But I take it a step further. I say that the kind of feedback loops which will have developed out of the initial steps towards phenomenal consciousness, the evolution of sensation before it became phenomenal, will at some point have reached a point where the brain suddenly became the home to these re-entrant loops, the activity circling around, and in the process of that, doing something extraordinary. We know from the mathematics that if you have a feedback loop, it can, and it's coming back to itself and changing its conductance, its properties as it goes around each time. You generate attractor states. Now, attractor states are mathematical notions. They're basically highly complex, stable states which emerge in the activity of a looping system like that. And they have extraordinary properties. An attractor state generated by a simple feedback loop can have not just one or two or three dimensions, not just 100 dimensions. It can have an infinite number of dimensions.
Okay, so we're going to talk about the feedback loops and the whole approach to how you generate consciousness in the next part. I want to keep focusing on the evolutionary part, which you're saying that it can be a step function event because of the what it was needed to create that.
Yes,
And this is very original and very iconoclastic, and I admire you for bringing that to everyone's attention when the groupthink is exactly the opposite.
Well, including my great friend Dan Dennett, who we really can't agree about this. He's always said that consciousness comes in every possible grade. I mean, from hemi, demi, semi consciousness right the way up to the conscious experience, which we have phenomenal consciousness that we have. I don't see he has any warrant for saying that. It's not that he's measured it or that he's observed it in animals or anything else. It's simply that he thinks it must be so because nature abhors discontinuities in the way it abhors vacuums. Okay.
I mean, a natural intuition would be what Dan says.
And Darwin, of course, Darwin was said the same. And I agree. It's basic. It's a received wisdom of evolutionary science.
Sure. I'm happy to be with Dan Dennett and Charles Darwin in that area. But as I said, your intervention in saying no, that traditional wisdom may not be correct is very valuable, and I like that a lot.
Yes, and I point to a lot of other examples in nature of discontinuities. They're not rare in nature. In fact, they're occurring all over the place, and we also know of them occurring in the evolution of the brain. The evolution of language, for example, involved a pretty major discontinuity between a brain capable of transformational grammars and one which was just working at the level of gestures and symbols.
Sure. And that's controversial. We've talked to Noam Chomsky, and that's, of course, his view that it was a step function occur. Other people would disagree with that in certain ways. But it's a critical point in the whole discussion of consciousness. Indeed, it's critical to evolution, too, because it's recursive. If you are right about phenomenal consciousness being a step function event, that impacts the whole nature of evolution itself. So very significant kind of point.
It also impacts the moral argument, because of course it means that we shouldn't expect to have different degrees of concern about all the different levels of phenomenal consciousness in the animal kingdom. If there's a real absolute difference between those who have it, let's say it's going to be chimpanzees and monkeys and pigeons, and those who don't, like lobsters and earthworms and so on, then we can make a basic distinction in how we treat them. Now, you'll read in the literature of animal ethics that now, you know, people are increasingly worried about our locust conscious. If we farm them for food, for example, do we need to introduce notion of locust rights? And just as we might have, of course, and we should have chimpanzee rights, we don't want to farm them for food. But the argument makes the assumption that there's this continuity all the way up, and we should be concerned all the way down. I think, fortunately, that's not true. We don't have, for example, to adopt the morality of the Jain monks who sweep the dust in front of their path in order to make sure they don't tread on an insect. I've got no compunction about treading on an insect. I don't think insects are phenomenally conscious.
The moral considerations are directly derivative of your theory and would be absolutely correct. But conversely, I mean, you couldn't go from a moral principle that we would all like, because it'd be very clear. You can't use that as justification for the theory in reverse. You can say, if the theory is correct, we have this corollary, this very nice result where it will help our moral issues. But that nice result doesn't justify the theory, correct?
Of course, right. Yes, of course.
Okay. Well, let me tell you the point. I love all this stuff, but let me tell you the point in your evolutionary story that gives me some concern, okay? you have some phrases where you talk about a breaks of fortune in evolution, or shocking evolutionary events, or strokes of serendipity to get us this phenomenal consciousness. I mean, those kinds of terms, lucky accidents, you know, kind of make me nervous. Shouldn't I be nervous?
Well, why does it make you nervous? Are you that you don't want to believe you got to where you are because of some series of accidents? I take that as a kind of compliment to your individuality and mine, and to the individuality of the human species and of life on Earth in general. I think it's an extraordinary and probably unrepeatable sequence, which means that we shouldn't have necessarily expect to find either life or conscious life or phenomenally conscious life anywhere else in the universe. I like that idea.
This is a big idea, and we're gonna talk a little bit about that later in terms of a consequence of what you're saying. That's a really important kind of whole characterization of the nature of reality. It goes way beyond in terms of importance, and I think that is a natural consequence of what you're saying. All right, let's now move on. We've talked about it some, about the so-called hard problem. How do you get phenomenal consciousness out of physical matter? They seem to be radically different categories, not even compatible, without even any idea how this can happen. And you've begun to describe it. I'd like to move a little bit back, because an important point that you make to begin the discussion of how you get sentient mentality out of physical matter is to distinguish between the so-called neural correlates of consciousness, which is what Christoph Koch works on. Francis Crick, they originally worked together on that, originating that. But you transform that to the neural correlates of representing consciousness, adding a big R to the NCC, then CRC, as a two-step process. So how does representation of consciousness soften the hard problem?
Well, it means that we shouldn't expect to go looking for proper activity in the brain which actually has the properties which are being represented. Christoph Koch, and now he's now very keen on integrated information theory, that begins with the idea that there must be some isomorphism between the structure of information flow in the brain and the experience of phenomenal consciousness. In other words, they're identical. But I think that's simply a misstep. We shouldn't expect things to work out like that. And I use the analogy of a text. A text does not have the properties of what it represents. A story doesn't have to actually you could go looking forever at the printed text of a book, and you would never discover the qualities which are being represented by that text once it's read by an agent who can understand that representation. Now, that's, I think, exactly what's happened in the evolution of phenomenal consciousness. The brain since offered up to the mind a text, which is then taken to be the experience which we then report on. Representations are, in fact, what the brain trades in. Representations are what give us all our ideas and our thoughts and our reports and so on. So if we can show that the brain is representing something as having the properties which we report and which we admire and which we are puzzled and bamboozled by, that's just fine. That will have solved the hard problem. There isn't a problem beyond what's being generated as our take on what it's like to be ourselves. You can say, oh yeah, but there must be something more to it than just how we think of ourselves. But no, there isn't anything more to it than that. And how could there be? What else do we know about what it's like to be us than what we think of as it being like to be us? Now, people have said, okay, well, thoughts don't seem to exactly correspond to phenomenal redness or phenomenal pain, for example. No, thoughts are largely expressed in language in our case. But in the far past, philosophers like David Hume and John Locke and others all used the term idea to represent qualities of experience going far beyond the things which we can express in language.
So the neural correlates of consciousness versus the neural correlates of representing consciousness sounds to me a bit like a distinction without much of a difference, because the attempt for either of them is a kind of identity theory to try to find something in the brain that is with a strong is, and like if and only if it is there in the brain. So why is not a representation of consciousness with neural correlates, whether it's circuitry or whatever, another kind of identity theory?
Well, it is, in a sense, a kind of identity theory, but it's not one you'd take literally as saying that this bit of the brain or this activity in the brain has the properties which we're trying to understand. To give you examples, there are a good many philosophers who've speculated, neurophysiologists for that matter, about whether little bits of the cortex could be sentient, could be having phenomenal experience just in isolation. And of course, this goes along with the idea that maybe bits of nerve cells, nervous tissue growing in a petri dish could also be having phenomenal experience. Well, no, they couldn't, because the most that is possibly going to be there is something which, if it was then read by a mind, could have the qualities which we're talking about. But you have to have that step towards introspective representation. Now, I'm not alone, of course, in saying that introspection is crucial to consciousness. But once you recognize it in the way I suggest, it means we're going to have to look for two different things in the brain. First will be the substrate, the representation, and secondly will be the interpretive process, which takes this to have the properties which we then report and marvel at.
Okay, but in doing so, in making this claim that you're improving the capacity of the material brain to explain phenomenal consciousness by moving to representation, is a step. We can argue that back and forth, but I think also critical in making your argument is that you work towards diminishing the nature of consciousness in terms of what we think we experience when we see red or taste honey in that immediate moment, that thickness of time, that it seems like that after that passes, it diminishes or extinguishes so quickly that maybe we are actually less, that the phenomenal nature, the sentient nature, as you put it, of our experiences is kind of less than we think. So there's less to explain than maybe what we think we have to explain. Is that fair?
I'm not sure, because I think you're implying that somehow if it's there's less to explain, it's less important.
No. It's just not less important, but maybe easier to explain, makes your task, your materialistic task, a little bit easier.
The task I see for a materialist is to explain why people come up with the reports about what it's like to be themselves, to experience sensations that they do, and why their lives are affected by it in the ways they are. In other words, I want to know what the function of these representations in the brain is. If we can tie those down, then we'll have solved the problem of consciousness. There won't be anything left over which we haven't explained. There won't be something which we say, oh yes, but there's another aspect to experience which somehow isn't covered by your theory, because everything is covered by a theory of what it's like to be us and what we say and think and do about it. Now, that's an important point, because it means that the quest can stop at some point. Once we've explained that, then we've done it, and we don't need to go on worrying that we've left something out.
Yeah, and you also use that same argument to deal with Mary, the colorblind neuroscientist, which we don't need to go into in detail. Frank Jackson's idea that Mary will know everything about the spectrum and how nerve cells react and the entire physiology, but if she was colorblind and suddenly got her capacity to see color, she would now know something that she didn't know before. And your critique is that she wouldn't, in a sense.
Oh, no, I say she would know something. She would know. She would have learnt it all from examining the brains. You're right about that. And what I say in that section on the Mary thought experiment is that when we say, would Mary know what it's like to see red, we ought to think about what we know about what it's like to see red.
Right.
And actually, it's not that obvious that we know as much as we might think we do. When you're not looking at a red object, then what's it like to see red? Of course, we have some vague a memory of it, and we can provide some kind of description of it, but we don't have knowledge of what it's like to be red or to feel pain when we're not in that state ourselves. There's a new work on pain, which has said how extraordinary it is, how difficult it is to reimagine pain, to know what it's like when we're not in it. And I think the same is true of seeing red and tasting sweetness and hearing sounds and so on. We think we know so much about them because when we're actually experiencing it, they're so impressive and obviously real for us. But as soon as the moment has passed, then it's over with. And what we know there are a lot of things to explain about what we know, but it doesn't. We aren't left with something which is going to be beyond description.
You focus on brain circuits and recursive brain circuits in the development and the sudden appearance of phenomenal consciousness as an attractor with mathematical characteristic to it, and use a new word to describe this, and you deliberately choose an unpleasant, complicated word to represent it. And if I pronounce it correctly, it's ipsundrum, if I'm not sure which syllable you accent. But how does that progress our explanation of the hard problem?
Well, the term ipsundrum I take from conundrum. I think to go back to the example of the original impossible triangle, Richard Gregory, psychologist, many years ago, made a real model of the impossible triangle out of wood. And it turns out that this object made of wood, it's a very peculiar shape. If you look at it from just the right point of view, it seems to have impossible properties. Now, Richard Gregory agreed with me that a good word for that impossible object would be the Gregundrum, called after him. So then later on, I came to saying, well, there's something rather like the impossible triangle in our heads, something the brain is creating, and which we then, seeing it from a particular point of view, read as having these properties. Since it's a self-generated conundrum, then from ipse for self and conundrum again, I call it the ipsundrum. But I wanted it to be a word which would stop people in their tracks, because I think it's a surprising and rather shocking idea that there's something in the brain which does have a real thing in the brain, an activity of the brain circuits, which has these extraordinary properties when looked at from the right point of view.
Look, I want to go back to where we started and recognize that over the last several decades, certainly since you and I spoke a little more than 10 years ago, there's been an increase in non-physicalist, as we know physicalism today, explanations of consciousness, not only among philosophers, but among certain scientists as well. And this expresses itself, you mentioned panpsychism, that is certainly true, but there's also a recrudescence of idealism where everything is consciousness, and the panpsychics and the idealists, they fight together, so it's not just you against them, but they have their own interaction. Then there's quantum theories of consciousness, where you have to have quantum effects because it's non-computable. And then integrated information theory, which is sort of a mechanism. It's sort of panpsychic, but has its own characteristics. So I guess my question is, I know you think this is all going in the wrong direction, and you call panpsychism a really bad idea, not just a bad idea, but a really bad one. Why is that? Why has that development been happening? That people, you know, they're well familiar with the neuroscience. The neuroscience is increasing, but yet there is this trophism towards non-physicalism.
Well, I think it comes down to the question of what consciousness, what effect it has on us. We regard consciousness as being wonderful, extraordinary, something which we believe couldn't easily come out of the material world. We think of ourselves as being spiritual beings who have this access to this world of the soul and of this magical dimension of consciousness. Now, that's a very important function of consciousness. It makes us think of ourselves as being outside of matter. And we can talk later, perhaps, about why that proved so valuable in terms of evolution. But just because, I mean, people do think of it in consciousness in that way, and therefore they seek explanations which are as mysterious as the phenomenon itself. They don't want to believe that it could be a reductive physicalist explanation, because somehow that would just take the magic away. It would unweave the rainbow in a way which would be damaging and distressing to the people if they ever really believed it. Not that anyone really will ever believe in the physicalist basis of consciousness, because it's too hard to take on board as a kind of emotional proposition. But if you talk to Koch and others, Koch once wrote to me that qualia are so unbelievable they could only have been invented by God. Now, Christofferson himself is actually a believing Christian, and maybe he really believes that God has a hand in it and has generated something which scientists will never be able to explain away without invoking some kind of spiritual background to it. But I think the same motivations there right the way through all these other theories. People want to believe that consciousness has to involve something spooky, something which can't simply correspond to the Newtonian, for that matter, the Einsteinian physics, which we have assumed to be the best way of explaining the universe.
I think that argument is entirely correct, but I don't think it's entirely correct in its own sense, but I don't think it's entirely applicable to everyone. There are many philosophers, for example, who say that we cannot even imagine what a theory could be like. There's no possibility of that. So it's not just a motivation of wanting to find God or find some spiritual nature. Tom Nagel famously says, you know, it's not only that I think there's no God, I hope there's no God. And yet he, of course, is very much that consciousness is non-physical in its traditional physical manner. So I think it's broader than just a hope for a spirituality or a grander thing. I mean, I think there are people, you know, myself included, who really don't see how any identity theory with the brain can result in qualia, because the way I look at any theory, including the representation theory, at the end of the day is some kind of identity theory.
Well, I don't know whether you mean that. You can understand an identity theory and a representational theory, understand how that would explain everything we think and talk about and respond to in our own consciousness, and yet it wouldn't explain wouldn't solve the hard problem. I don't see what's missing, Robert. If we've done that, we've solved the problem. But to come back to the motivation of those of the rest of them, yes, I know. You know, I have many of my good friends are panpsychists, and I understand why they feel more comfortable with that explanation, and more part of the elbow if they want it, because it's for many years, and I mean not for many years, but for many millennia, human beings have believed that consciousness is a non-physical process and brings us closer to God, and it has had remarkable consequences for human evolution, human cultural evolution. It's allowed us to enter what I've called the soul niche. With the ecological niche we live in is one in which we think of other human beings as spiritual beings whose souls are intrinsically immaterial and maybe can survive after death and so on. So I'm not belittling those sorts of theories as folk theories. I think they work for us, and we're all the better in entertaining them. But they're not science. It's integrated information theory. It just seems to me not in the in the canon of natural science. And you may say, well, okay, well, maybe there are, you know, we should go beyond science, and we'll not expect to have scientific explanations of everything. I would say, okay, let's at least give it a try. And what I've been doing for the last 50 years is been giving it a try with every resource which I can find in physical science.
And I think that's terrific. And I think your contribution is extremely important, especially because the trend is in the other direction. Therefore, what you are doing is a major contribution. In fact, you say a strength of your theory makes certain kinds of predictions, that it rules out semi-sentient creatures, and therefore has a sharper division than most people, most scientists, or most philosophers would see in terms of the nature of consciousness. And therefore, you conclude that consciousness or phenomenon of sentience is restricted to only certain categories, and you single out mammals and birds for that, and see various kinds of sort of non-cognitive consciousness beyond cognition for curiosity or hunger or calories or sex or something that would be part of the cognitive consciousness of creatures. But you see the phenomenal consciousness being restricted to mammals and birds.
Robert, don't get me wrong about what I think the end result of this evolution is being. I say in the book that the phenomenal consciousness is such a sublime invention that if it was ever lost, the universe would be severely diminished. It is an extraordinary and unexpected, and in a sense, it's easy to believe it, a God-given development in the history of life. But while that's my valuation of it, but it's not my explanation of it. And going back to the question of which animals I believe, in fact, have gone that way, I was looking for a point at which we might think there would have been a discontinuity. Has something happened in the evolution of vertebrate or animal brains in general where a stepwise change occurred in the course of evolution? Well, there is one. It's the advent of warm-bloodedness. And people haven't taken seriously what a change that was. I haven't seen any account of what the effect on the brain must have been of suddenly increasing a temperature of the body and the brain from, let's say, 10, 12 degrees centigrade up to 37 degrees centigrade. The effect would have been that nerve conduction speeds would have perhaps have tripled. Suddenly we'd have a brain working three times as fast as anything in history before that. Now, that gives me a possible explanation of why there should have been a step change in actually these internal loops in the brain and the generation of attractor states. And then along with that, I thought, well, okay, what else was changing in the animals' lives? And of course, what was happening when warm-blooded animals evolved about 200 million years ago, but suddenly they were freed from their physical environment. They became independent spirits in a way they'd never been before. They could leave behind the constraints of the physical environment and temperature and so on, which had dogged them for all their earlier history and evolution. So at that point, I think, the notion of selfhood and individuality and free will and free and ability to be oneself and to be independent of the world around us, which is a core notion of being oneself, would very likely have emerged. And of course, once we attributed that to the other creatures in the same state as us, who also were flying and dancing and running around suddenly with this new independence of the physical world, I think that would have given the function for the brain taking on these new states, which had suddenly become available because of the increase in temperature of the brain. As I said in the book, as cometh the mind, cometh the brain.
Let's go on to some very specific topics that are related to your theory. I want to get your sense. We've just a little time, so just very quick comments to a few of these. Let's start with the hot topic of the day, artificial intelligence, AI, consciousness. Will AI ever be really conscious?
Well, I mean, of course it could be. Whether we will go that way in terms of engineering AI, I'm not sure either that we will or that we should. But I think we can be quite certain that nothing in existence in the realm of AI has even a smidgen of consciousness.
Let's do this in three parts. We know that AI is intelligent in terms of certain ways of defining intelligence, and it has been for a long time, really, getting more and more intelligent. But let's use your other two terms. We have intelligence. Now we have cognitive consciousness, which is this inner aware sense you have without the sentience, without the phenomenality, and then phenomenal consciousness. Are those two step functions, and you're saying both can be engineered, or only the cognitive?
No, I think in principle they both could be. I think we are all on the verge already of making machines which are cognitively conscious. It's a very good trick in terms of designing an information processing brain, and I'm sure that that engineers, not necessarily copying natural selection and evolution, nonetheless will come to that idea of having a global workspace in which ideas can be observed by an inner self, which can then act as the focus for making decisions and so on. It's already a part of the architecture of artificial intelligences. Now, none of that will give sentience. None of it will create phenomenal consciousness because it won't have been designed to do that. So it's central to my theory that evolution designed phenomenal consciousness in separately and later after cognitive consciousness had evolved. Now, whether we would want to do that for machines, it would depend what purpose would be. Most of the jobs which we give machines to do wouldn't be helped at all by making them sentient. And in fact, it might in fact even get in the way, and partly, of course, because we'd begin to have moral scruples about how we should relate to these machines. On the other hand, there may come a time when we will want to introduce sentience for another reason. And that's because we will want to make machines which can interact with human beings on a human level, which will understand us, appreciate us, regard us as individuals in the way which we, all of us, treat other human beings. In our case, this is secondary to our being sentient and having a phenomenal self, which we can then inspect in our own case, admire and revere in our own case, and then attribute to other human beings as well. I feel, therefore I am. You feel, therefore you are too. Now that's the way humans relate to each other. It's just possible that at some point we'll want robots to relate to us in that way. And it's conceivable that engineers will decide to take a leaf from nature's book and to introduce sentience as a way for moving them to this new...
And you believe that is doable with the building some sort of this mathematical attractor, this recursive circuits, is an engineering task. It's not new principles of science.
If it's been done in the human brain and in the dog brain and all these other brains, which where it's already proved such a success, of course it could be duplicated in principle. There's no new physics involved.
Okay, you don't need quantum physics. You don't need a lot of other things that are being postulated. Okay, let's go on. We have a couple other things. Give me a couple of sentences about social intelligence and what your theory then reflects back on the nature of social intelligence.
Well, that's a very big question, Robert. I mean, I've been writing and thinking about social intelligence for a very long time now. I came to the idea that social intelligence had been the driving force in the evolution of the human brain from working with gorillas in Rwanda, where I was shocked to find that the gorillas with their huge brains apparently didn't seem to be needing them for anything that I could see going on in front of my eyes. And then I realized that, of course, what I was missing was their social relationships, their need to make friends, to appease, to outwit other individuals in their social group. That requires intelligence of a very high order. And so that gave me the idea that actually, at least among primates, but probably many other animals, the brain evolution of the brain, and particularly the size of the brain, has been driven by the need to develop highly skilled social skills, that animals had to become what I've called natural psychologists. Now, the way we do psychology, we humans do it, I'm not talking about the way therapists do it in the clinic necessarily, but the way ordinary people relate to others is by putting themselves in the other person's place and working out what I would do if I were you. But you can only put yourself in the other person's place if you know what it's like to be you to begin with. And what you know about yourself is dependent on your being a conscious, sentient being.
What comes out in the book so strongly, and I think it's wonderful, are these two big areas of research that you've developed: social intelligence from your work with gorillas in their natural habitat, and blindsight. And those two were the empirical data that you used to develop the theory. I think that's a wonderful product of the book that is very instructive on multiple levels and a unique contribution. And that comes out very clearly. So I recommend it to everyone to see the methodology of thinking of how theories are developed, not a cappella out of the blue, but based upon these two very fundamental areas of fundamental research.
Robert, can I say it shows the importance of serendipity. I mean, I had an amazing set of lucky breaks. The discovery of blindsight, I didn't set out to do research on blindsight. I discovered it by accident in a way. I didn't set out to go and work with Diane Fossey or realize that when I was there, I would find myself measuring gorilla skulls, thinking about how clever these animals must be, and then wondering about what they were using their intelligence for. I've been astonishingly fortunate in that.
Yeah, and we are fortunate that you've done that and presented in this great book. Give me a few words on parapsychology. I was surprised to find that in your book. You interacted with C.D. Broad, one of the famous fathers of the Society for Psychical Research. I've been interested in that, and I was surprised to find it in your book. Give me a few words. As you said, this all struck me as crazy.
Well, I've I think, like almost everybody, been fascinated by the possibility of paranormal phenomena, telepathy and ghosts and so on, since I was a boy. I mean, it's natural to humans to speculate about these things. How do all these strange coincidences come to occur in our lives and so on? And so I joined up with people who were doing research on it, including Professor Broad, who was then in his 80s, who invited me to undertake some experiments involving himself and studying the caravans which were being moved around by poltergeists. So yes, I it was fun. It was also terribly interesting. And out of that, I made some television programs about paranormal phenomena. And at one point, I took a research fellowship, senior research fellowship at Darwin College, Cambridge, in parapsychology. The money for that research fellowship had been given in order to promote a study of the survival of the human mind after death. Now, there was no way I was going to do research directly on that issue because I didn't for a moment believe in the survival of the human mind after death, but I had to believe and had no problem in believing that many people think the human mind survives after death. And so what I did was to write a book, it was called Leaps of Faith, about the psychological background of belief in survival, and which I think, and its belief in the survival of the human soul, which drives many of the, a lot of the interest in other paranormal phenomena.
You end the book with a very grand vision of phenomenal consciousness in the cosmos. And I'm just going to just read some of the things you talked about because it's really a grand vision. You start by saying the chances of phenomenal consciousness having evolved anywhere else in the universe, you call vanishingly small, and that the phenomenal consciousness itself is an ultimate achievement, the crowning glory of the evolutionary process that began not with life on Earth, but began with the Big Bang. And you say that it's an invention so sublime that if it were to cease to exist, which means the extinction of humanity for self-caused reasons, that would indeed diminish the whole of creation. So talk to me about that, the importance of phenomenal consciousness in the cosmos. That sounds anti-Copernican in a way.
Well, I don't know what you want me to say beyond what you've just read out. I mean, it's my book is a kind of paean of adulation for natural selection's creativity in creating something which was totally unexpected, unnecessary for most of life on Earth, but which nonetheless, in the particular line of animals which led to us, brought us into a different realm. And I think it wasn't a necessary consequence of evolution. It didn't have to occur even on Earth, but it's very unlikely to have occurred anywhere else because of the lucky breaks which it involved in the particular case of the evolution of our own his brains and our minds in the context of the earthly environment. I of course I know that there are theories, in fact they're widely accepted, that the universe is so large that almost anything must have occurred somewhere else as well. But I'm not sure that's true. One-off events can occur even in an infinite universe. And I think that this one-off event in our own case is something which we should both acknowledge, but also it makes us realize the responsibility it puts on us. When I was thinking about the development of artificial intelligence with sentient consciousness, with phenomenal consciousness, I suggested that one of the reasons we might want to do it was because we might recognize that in the end, humans are not going to survive. Life on Earth is not going to survive so many billions of years to go. At some point, we may say, well, we have a duty to reproduce this phenomenon and seed the rest of the universe with it before human life itself becomes extinct, and with it goes sentience.
With that grand vision, Nick, thank you very much for the book, for our conversation. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Sentience, the invention of consciousness, is an important original contribution to serious consciousness studies. And all those who have non-materialistic views, in which I would occasionally include myself, at least to entertain, really need to engage with this book in terms of its methodology and its way of thinking. It's an important part of the continuing approach to consciousness. Viewers can watch hundreds of Closer to Truth videos on consciousness, including Nick's 12 topic videos on our website and the Closer to Truth YouTube channel. He's in five television episodes of Closer to Truth with others, giving contrasting points of view. Nick, once again, thank you very much, and thank you everyone for watching.
Robert, thank you again. It's a privilege to talk to you.
To watch complete conversations with over 100 of the world's leading thinkers on cosmos, consciousness, and meaning, visit our website, closertotruth.com.